to build off the youth perspective. You know, I grew up in hip hop. Hip hop saved my life. And the reason I bring that up is because until there's an intergenerational dialogue that acknowledges hip hop as a force and as a culture of resistance against oppression, we continue to have this, you know, this schism between older folks and, you know, younger folks, first of all. Second, like in New York City, right, 67% of the Latinos don't even graduate from high school. So how am I going to be in the streets of Flatbush talking about affirmative action? And that's something, that's a college issue, right? So then we even talk about issues of middle class, you know, and who priests from affirmative action, you know, and again, I'm a person who got into both my universities through some affirmative action program, you know, and I think at every level we should fight, you know, they inundate us with fights on a daily basis. You know, when you're walking down the street, get stopped by the police, trying to go to Howard Law School to then take, you know, all these tests to become a lawyer. We understand that as a hip hop generation. But I think we really need to frame it in a grassroots orientated issue. And us who call ourselves activists cannot be an elite activist, which is to say we can't be just always on panels. Not saying that's not a disrespect to anyone here, because I admire everybody's work here. But in particular, what's going on with the affirmative action debate too now is this whole issue of the census and so-called Hispanic Americans. First of all, I am not Hispanic. I take offense to that term. I hate it. It was a term that actually means I'm from Spain. I am not white. I'm a black Puerto Rican. I'm an African. When we begin to frame and even begin to identify ourselves in terms that this government does not want us to identify, that's revolutionary, because everyone in here who looks like me, you're my brother and my sister. What they're doing with this whole issue of now saying Hispanic Americans have become the largest minority group, what is that? No, and when you mark off the census, Hispanic American, not of black origin, what are you talking about? Like, that's again, the insanity that then begins to even pit in this affirmative action debate, as a sister was saying, black and brown people against each other, right? So we need to even begin to reframe the language and the paradigms. And then if we talk to young people from that perspective and say, as Dr. Malvo said, it's not only about getting into college, this is about jobs also. And our ability for those who want to be hardcore capitalists and work in corporate America, you know, but that's true. Your ability to do that is being even taken away. So we really got to talk to brothers and sisters from that perspective. New York, we got more men locked up that are being admitted to college. So then the larger issue is, let's talk about reparations and not just affirmative action. And I think we're all kind of coming from a hardcore perspective up here. But I think you talk to young people about reparations. Now, that's something the hip-hop generation is mobilizing around. And that's real.
Let me ask you all this question. And I'm going to go to Robin Linhart to give the first answer and then to George Curry. It seems we have two contradictions. There's no question, certainly from the perspective of, I think, all of us on this stage, that affirmative action has done a lot of positive good, that affirmative action has accomplished a lot of things. At the same time, what I'm also hearing a lot of you say is that there are significant gaps between how African Americans are doing and how other aspects of society are doing. Now, some of the people who are critics of affirmative action raise the question, if affirmative action has been so successful, if it's been so important, why do we still have these gaps? Now, that's a question that I think that we ought to talk about tonight. And Robin, can you open that discussion for us?
I can, but I want to respond to an earlier question you answered, because I think it's very important. The question of what will happen if there is a loss in the Supreme Court, and I agree with my sisters on the panel who've talked about the importance of looking to what happens in secondary and elementary education, looking at what happens in economics. But in terms of what will happen in education, higher education, I think we need to focus on that and be clear. And I think I started off the conversation tonight by being very legalistic, so I want to be very real with you on this. While it's true that we need to be pushing on all fronts, if there is an adverse decision in the Michigan cases, what we will see is the resegregation of institutions of higher education. I don't mean one or two. I don't mean only Michigan or Harvard. It is the case that following Bakke, almost every selective institution of higher education in this country adopted the plan, the Harvard plan, approved in education. If this court strikes it down, even if, and I think my friend James Forman was being very optimistic, even if the court says, well, we don't like these programs, but it's still permissible, the truth is that what they will be saying is that affirmative, that the use of race is fatal in fact. The practical effect of saying you can't do what Michigan does when all of the schools do it is resegregation. And we know this. It's not just a theoretical matter. We know this from what happened in California, what happened in Texas. These schools, these institutions in these states saw an incredible, precipitous drop in the enrollment of students of color. And we need to be very clear about that. I think that UCLA went from having, you know, 30 students of color to 2 in the first year, 2 African-Americans following the adoption of 209 in California. That's what we're facing here. And while it shouldn't be our only fight as a community, we need to be focused on that because that is a real and serious loss.
I think, George Corey, let me, if you want to follow up on
now
that.
See, I talked too much. I lost my chance.
But let me also ask you my second question.
You asked me 2 questions.
I'm going to ask you 2 questions. The first question I'm going to ask you is this. Talk to me about a world where we've had 25 years plus of affirmative action. At the same time, we have significant gaps that still exist in the African-American community and that exist between the African-American community and the white community. Talk to me about those 2 contradictions.
I'm going to talk to you from a very basic level. Neither of my parents finished high school, so I didn't get any extra points for going to college. I grew up in a housing project. So I benefited from poverty program. I went to Sports Illustrated. I was the only black face there among reporters because of affirmative action. So I got an opportunity, the son of neither parents who finished high school, to move ahead in this country because of affirmative action. Now, the problem is the critics, and I know them. I did a book, The Affirmative Action Debate, has the critics and the people who are supporters. And the critics say, well, it doesn't help poor people. Well, it helped me. Secondly, the affirmative action program is not an anti-poverty program. And when we had anti-poverty program, the people who were critical of it, they were not supporting those. We need affirmative action, and we still need a real anti-poverty program. That's why we have the gaps, but we have another problem too. We have a gap and notch. And that's in part because of my profession. I'm a journalist, I've been one for 33 years. But the problem is that the media has adopted the language of the far right in discussing affirmative action. First of all, they say it's race-based. Well, that's a lie. That's right. There's not a university in this country that accepts you based on your race. That's right. Not even black colleges. Or they say it was gender-based. They don't accept you because of your sex. They accept you because of your qualification. Then you got George Bush and others saying, well, it's a quota program. Well, first of all, he can read, and I hope he can. He would know the Executive Order 11246 that established affirmative action specifically forbids quotas. He knows that. The right wing knows that it forbids quotas, yet they want to use it as a buzzword. So you got it mystifying in the media. You have polls that are worded in such a way that you get different results. When you ask the American public, including the white folk, do you support a qualified person benefiting from affirmative action that will open up doors that have been closed to them? They say yes. But if you use the loaded term preference, which is what the media has adopted, they're going to say no. Let me construct a poll. I can dictate the outcome.
James Foreman, and I want to ask, I want to go to Dr. Tatum, and I want to follow up on something that George Curry just talked about. If the Michigan program is struck down, I want to keep us on that level for one more second. What a lot of people will propose as an alternative is that we have class-based admissions, that we have a resort to poverty as a factor instead of race. You can make whatever points you want to make, but I want you and then Dr. Tatum to address that argument. Why isn't that good enough? Why isn't it sufficient to have a program that takes into account class as opposed to just race? Because isn't that going to be what ends up happening in some ways if these programs are struck down, James?
Yeah, the first thing I want to speak to is this question of why, your last question, which is why do we have all these problems in our community and these disparities in society if affirmative action has been working so well? And I think that's a really, it's an important question because it's a disingenuous argument that people make on this. Because, I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., and so do most of the people in this room. And we know that we live in a city that doesn't have enough money for its school system, that doesn't have good affordable housing, that doesn't have a social safety network, that doesn't have adequate health care. And so we have black and brown children growing up in this city who are suffering because of that. That's a separate issue from affirmative action. People are benefiting and should benefit from affirmative action, but that doesn't mean that we as a nation don't have a responsibility to deal with those other issues. And when we don't deal with those other issues, we sure shouldn't be blaming affirmative action for the fact that we have those problems. We need to be dealing with the fact that we're not addressing those problems. But related to that, and it also goes to, and we need to deal with who is attacking these programs. Because the people that are attacking these programs often say, look, you know, we have the elite in black America who benefit from these programs, and the real issues are poverty and the children that can't benefit, the lower class children, they're not benefiting from affirmative action. And my question is, if that's what you really believe, if you really believe the problem is schools and health care and housing, then where are you on the front lines doing something about that issue? No, seriously, if all of the energy and the money of the conservative think tanks that were attacking affirmative action were spent helping working class children in our cities, then we might be able to make some progress on that issue. So I really think we should not let them off the hook when they make that argument. Now, in terms of what will happen on with these class-based plans, I would like to defer to either Robin or Elaine, who I know have been thinking specifically about that issue. I think they could respond to that better than I could.
We'll go to them. We'll give Dr. Tatum a chance to go next.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to just say a word about the class-based question, and that is that there are more poor white people in the country than there are poor people of color. So if you have a class-based program, it's going to advantage whites disproportionately. But my original comment had to do with your question about why is it that despite affirmative action, we still see these differences. And I want to bring a perspective that I haven't heard represented on the panel, and that's the perspective of a psychologist. There is a lot of research on what psychologists call evaluation bias. And this is the notion that when people are trying to evaluate someone's performance, they don't do it neutrally. The lens of race is always there. There's a very a wide body of research in social psychology that says that when white evaluators are looking at performances of white people and black people and comparing them, bias creeps in. What's really interesting about where that bias creeps in is that the more talented the black candidate is, the more likely there is to be bias against that person. So that when candidates are the same, you know, if you ask white evaluators, and John DeVidio, who's a social psychologist, has done a lot of this work, he says that when you have white and black candidates that are both poorly qualified, they both get rejected, no bias there. But when you have white candidates and black candidates that are both highly qualified, the black candidate is penalized for being highly qualified. That it's the socialization that we have, that we are exposed to, the media stereotypes about who is good and who isn't creeps in, and it's harder to detect for white raiders. It's harder for them to see the talent of a black candidate. And so consequently, when we talk about even affirmative action, you know, I have heard some people say, well, you don't need affirmative action if you're, quote, too good to ignore. If you're too good to ignore, you're more likely to be ignored because the bias creeps in there. So that's just one example. But there's a lot of research in psychology that indicates why it is so difficult to get beyond these barriers without formal structures in place.
Let me go back to this side as someone we haven't heard from in a while, Ted Wells. And then Julianne Mello.
If you want to talk about the success of affirmative action, I'll give you some concrete examples. As I said, I really believe the origin of affirmative action goes back to those classes that entered school in the fall of 68, fall of 69. And when I look back at the black folk that were at Harvard Law School with me, who would not have been there but for affirmative action, and what those people have done, it is astounding. We had one young brother in our class, his name was Kurt Smoke. He's your dean. We had another guy in my class, Ken Chenault, chairman of American Express. We had another guy, Frank Raines, chairman of Fannie Mae. We had Charles Ogletree. I mean, I'm talking about people who, but for affirmative action, would not have been at Harvard Law School, though I believe if we'd been at Howard, we still would have done okay. I want you to understand. Okay? But we're trying to spread the wealth. And when you look at the successes, I don't see how any policymaker can be serious about saying that affirmative action has not been successful. Now, some of the conservatives, they try to play this class thing, this economic thing now. They say, well, we want to have affirmative action for people who are underprivileged, but not people of color. I'm going to tell you, racism does not distinguish between rich black or poor black. You can be a lawyer making a big salary. You can put your kid in one of these private schools, and your child will come home every day scarred. Every day. So I don't want to hear anything about, oh, well, the lawyer's son, why should he get some extra privilege? Because he's getting his butt kicked like everybody else, and it's affecting him, just like it affects all of us, be you rich, middle class, or poor. So what we have to understand is that the conservative element is trying to craft certain arguments in order to appeal to the public. So we get these buzzwords, again, like preference and quotas. Quota, that's one of the big buzzwords, one of the hot issue buzzwords, because it makes people react. But we have to step back and realize, as somebody said a minute ago, it's one of the most insightful comments I've heard, that if the critics of affirmative action were so serious about the welfare of our country, about making progress, why aren't they spending their time focusing on the issues of poor schools, poor housing? They don't care. They focused on one thing, trying to kick us out of those schools. And that's what it's about, and it's terrible, and that's why it is political. And that's why all of you have to come out. Please listen to me. Come out on Tuesday. Come out in front of the Supreme Court in March.
Julianne Melvo.
I'm glad that Attorney Wells raised the issue of racism, because I haven't heard us talk very much about the institutional nature of racism. I mean, it is in the bowels of the fiber of the United States of America. There have been so many studies, Dr. Tatum, she talked about the performance, the evaluative bias. There was recently a study done by economists looking at people with the same qualifications and their names on admissions forms. Tammy is more likely to get into school than Tamika, you know? And we know that. Michael more likely than Malik. And we can go down the list. And so just that kind of bias continues to exist. So you ask the question, why do we still have gaps, economic gaps, wealth gaps, after 25 years of affirmative action? Well, how many years did we have slavery? How many years did we have Jim Crow? Was 25 years supposed to take us all the way back? One of the gaps that I like to look at as an economist is the home ownership gap. And that's an interesting gap to look at because it really does talk about class and transformation. If you own a home, you basically have some collateral, some wealth. 74% of all white Americans own their homes compared to 47% of black and brown people. Now, why is that? We can tease it out. Part is because black and brown people have less money. But part of it also is that we can still demonstrate banking bias. We can take that bias from the banking industry into every other industry in our economy. And when we take those biases into every industry, we have to fall back and look at this issue of institutional racism. It's uncomfortable to do. The basic tension, I think, and it's a tension around affirmative action as well. The basic tension in the United States is the tension between viewing yourself as an individual and viewing yourself as part of a group. If you view yourself, and that's a trick bag conservatives will get you in. Is having, well, you're an individual. This is about individual achievement. Well, we didn't have individual slavery, you know. I mean, just for you, you know. I mean, I will never forget our uncle, Mr. Thomas, when he said in his... I'm sitting by George Perry, rubbed off.
That was the best cover ever in the world.
But when he said in his confirmation hearings, and it was very poignant, he said, I know segregation. My grandmother had to use a segregated bathroom. And I kept thinking, but the bathroom did not say, Clarence is Thomas's grandmama. Come here. What it says. Was colored. You know, so we have to look at the institutional piece of this. The signs don't say white or colored anymore. It's a different kind of racism. It's not about whether you have to go to the back of the bus. It's about whether you can own the bus company, whether you can zone the buses, whether you can decide what kinds of things you can import and export, whether you can decide where things are driven. There was a case in New York that Johnny Cochran successfully tried where a young sister was trying to cross a divided highway because the shopping mall said the bus could not stop in front of the project. So she crossed a divided highway and, of course, was killed by a truck. And bless Johnny for getting some money for her surviving son. But this is the kind of thing that happens every day. When you want to know why the gaps exist, it is because it is in the fabric of this country. It's economic, it's political, it's social. But most importantly, we have not constructed the language that the Balsa sister over here said, constructed the language to begin to unpack this. Affirmative action is not the most America can do for us. It frankly is the least that America can do for us.
Let me go to Wade Henderson next, and let me, as I do that, try to take us to a slightly different topic. Mr. Henderson, given the discussion that we're having tonight, what is the next battleground beyond affirmative action? It's kind of an extension of what this young lady was saying earlier. If we are successful or unsuccessful in the defense of the plan in Michigan, what is the next strategy that the African-American community needs to employ to close some of the gaps that we've talked about and to still accomplish the positives behind affirmative action? Mm. What is the next step in the battle?
You know, I think as a community, and I'm referring now to the community both racially and in terms of progressive political thought, we've been wrestling with that issue now since Bakke came down, and certainly the University of Michigan's case has once again brought it to the surface. And I think our young sister from Balsa, who talked about the need to construct a new political paradigm that talks about options in a variety of different ways, really is on money. I think we're going to need a multifaceted strategy to try to address some of the issues that Julianne in particular talked about, that my friend George and Elaine touched on. And I think you have to look at it in several ways. First, I think that Ted Wells touched on something early on when he mentioned the issue of remediation. And he talked about having lost the thrust behind remediation as a concept for reconstructing our communities for the loss we have collectively suffered. I think my friend Charles Ogletree struck on something when he and other colleagues like Johnny Cochran and Willie Gary, filed the first of a series of reparation lawsuits to begin to frame and articulate the issue of how we deal with this question. Don't be afraid of reparations, because it is grounded in Judeo-Christian principle. It is the foundation of equitable law in this country. For every wrong, there is a remedy. That is the basis of equity. And we have lost the issue of remediation, and the question of reparations puts that issue back on the table, square and center. So I do think we have to pursue a course of action around the issue of reparations. But I think we have to do that. We have to. But that is only one element of the tools that we have to employ to move us to where, Congressman, your question takes us.
Let me go to Charles Ogletree, because, hey, Charles, I know you have to leave.
Have I spoken too long, brother? Have I spoken too long?
He's got to leave.
Yeah,
that's the biggest problem we've got.
I
want to go to Charles Ogletree because I know that he has to leave before some other people do.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple of things, Congressman Davis, and that is sort of making sure we don't lose sight of the bigger issue here. Because I think as our community watches this program and looks at all these highly educated, highly influential African Americans talking about affirmative action, they are right to say, well, what about me?
Yeah.
And when we're talking about Yale and Harvard and Stanford, somebody at Morris Brown is going to say, what about me? And I think it's important. I just want to say this because the Michigan case is important. We have to fight that battle, but that's just a small battle. If we fight and keep the Harvards open for a few of us, and they close the Morris Browns for the most of us, we have lost that battle. The other thing I want to say is that as I reflect on this, I'm actually writing a book that will come out a year from now called All Deliberate Speed. It's about the 50th anniversary of Brown. And I have to say that as thrilled as we were in 1954 when we won that unanimous decision, those three words took it away. So there was a commitment to diversity and affirmative action and integration with all deliberate speed, which meant no speed at all. Mm-hmm. And so we cannot let even a favorable Supreme Court decision delude us into thinking that we've won something. We won Brown, and we were still faced with dogs and hoses. We won case after case, and we still didn't win. And so I think there's a larger argument, and that's why I appreciate Wade mentioned the issue of reparations, because I don't want to debate that tonight. I'm happy to debate it, but I don't want to debate it tonight. But the whole issue of our reparations movement, it's not about us. Not a single lawyer involved in this is getting any money. Every Johnny Cochran, Adjo Iaturo, Michelle Roberts, Dennis Sweet, Randall Robinson, Rose Sanders, Willie Gary, all the lawyers who are working with me are all doing it free. And we're representing now, as you might have heard, some black people who are 80 and 90 and 100 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one of the most horrific incidences of racial violence in the 20th century. And even they say it's not about them. Because they're saying that we don't want your money. It's not just about money. We want you to fix the problem. We didn't come here first class or even tourist class. We didn't ask to come here. We built this great city, the nation's capital, the White House, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, but not a single plaque is anywhere in this city to recognize what we've done. And so affirmative action is the most conservative, the most modest, the most minuscule response to a horrific history that we've had. And it hasn't stopped. If you think I'm lying, ask Amadou Diallo. If you think I'm lying, ask Abner Louima. And that's the issue here, that as much as we think we've made progress, as much as we have the Oprahs and the Bill Cosbys and all these other folks, we have a community that has never benefited from affirmative action, that has never benefited from integration. Our community is still stuck in neutral. And so our battle can't be just to get 5 votes on a decision. If we are satisfied with that, then our clients have fools for lawyers. We can't. We cannot be satisfied until we change the whole terrain in America. Where we won't have to talk about race again. But it's not going to happen because a few of us get a degree or a job or are allowed to go into the suites upstairs or get our face on TV. It's not going to happen until that child being born at a hospital right now will be able to say that I'm going to have a fair chance in America in spite of the fact that I'm black. And so we have to see the battle as much bigger than a case. It is a cause. It is a cause for our children, our grandchildren. It's for our descendants who are looking down saying, what did they do? We gave our lives. We gave our lives for them. What are we prepared to do for the next generation? That's the question that we have to ask not only Tuesday, but the work doesn't end on Tuesday. It starts on Tuesday. It starts on Tuesday, and our job is to make sure we do it for our entire community.
I had wanted to respond earlier to a lot of the things that Dr. Mavo has said. I'm sorry, I hate being the one Puerto Rican up here, you know, but I'm glad I'm here, regardless. Because when, first I wanted to say, I think when we see these gaps, I think about, again, language. First, you cannot legislate humanity. It's a God-given right. Ever since Africans have been enslaved and dispersed, we have to fight at so many levels that we try to actually get people to legislate what is a human right. Food, clothing, shelter, education, those are human rights. But unfortunately, we have to fight to actually even legislate them. And then even when they're legislated, are they really carried out? Hence why we have Anthony Bias, Amadou Diallo, Patrick Dorismond, and we can name hundreds and hundreds of names of brothers and sisters who've been murdered by the police. So I think, why would this government, conservatives or white supremacists, which is what they ultimately are, if they can't even admit that slavery was a crime against humanity, how are we gonna get them to support affirmative action? As Dr. Mavo said, it's the least that they can do, but they cannot admit, although at the UN Conference on World Racism, where I was a reparations youth representative, the whole world said that the U.S. reparations was a crime against humanity. I was there when Colin Powell, you know, and George, not Colin Powell, what's well, Colin Powell showed up for like a day and said he was walking out because of the Israel-Palestine. No, he walked out because of the issue of reparations. Because why? He went there because the issue up until that moment had been framed around an African-American issue. No. There's an Afro-Latino movement worldwide that is fighting for reparations, and they're the leading people right now outside of the United States. So when they began to see that, we're talking about black people coming together worldwide, as Malcolm was talking about, he was out of there like that. He bounced because he began to see the ability of us as black people, again, as black people, not African Americans, as black people globally, our power, right? So as Neely Fuller said, until one understands the system of white supremacy, everything and anything else will confuse you. So we have to talk about reclaiming our minds, reclaiming the, we have to get to the hearts and souls of the people. And lastly, can we talk about self-determination? Resegregation, I work in New York City public schools, okay? I live in Flatbush, Brooklyn. That's segregation. I'm not opposed to that. I love living with my people. What I'm opposed to is my ability to self-determine my faith and have economic equity. That's what I'm opposed to.
One of the things as moderator I have to do is have an invisible hourglass that no one can see but me. And it tells me something about who hasn't talked as much. Part of my job in the last half hour is to make sure that some people who've not talked as much get an opportunity to participate. So I want to go to Elaine Jones, and I want to move us in the 20 minutes we've got before we take questions from the audience to a slightly different issue. There's a lot of consensus on this panel about what our priorities ought to be. There's a lot of consensus about where we go from here. The political reality is that where we go from here is to a Congress that's controlled by Republicans in the House and Senate, to a White House that's controlled by a Republican president, and to a 2004 election cycle where that president is frankly likely to be reelected. We go from here to the president being able to appoint a Supreme Court that is probably going to be even worse than this Supreme Court. Those are the political realities that we're facing. So beginning with Elaine Jones, talk to me about the strategies that the people on this panel employ given the conservative political climate in this country and given the institutional control by the Republican Party of all of our branches of government. How do we get around that, beginning with Elaine Jones?
Not only by the people on this panel, but by our elected members of Congress that we have to give another message to.
But we are still in the minority, as you know. So. But we are still in the minority, and we still need a lot of help.
We've been a minority all our lives. Listen. And, you know, I know your state well. I spent the first 5 years as a practicing lawyer litigating death penalty cases all across the state of Alabama with Judge Clement and all across the state. So I hear what you're saying, but you see, remember, we go back and are we worthy of the legacies we've inherited? Fannie Lou Hamer, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired. You see, so first thing, we have political power that we don't use.
Yes.
The capital. We got it's you know, Jesse called them rocks lying around, votes that we don't cast, and and we have political discussions about why should I vote? They gonna do what they do anyhow. I mean, no, you know, you've been in those discussions. We have, that Voting Rights Act is still law. We just settling with the Justice Department redistricting case in Louisiana. We have, if we got out and exercised the franchise, not only exercised it, when folk are elected, hold them accountable. Yes. And hold them accountable. Hold them accountable. You know, you as a district office, you don't have to have the money to travel, but you ought to know what the agenda is. You ought to be in that meeting. And look, those of us who have the privilege and the blessing to be able to get a car.
There's a lot of consensus on this panel. What priorities are political reality is to a Congress and Senate, to a White House that's controlled by a Republican president, and to a 2004 election cycle that president is frankly likely to be. We go from here to the president being able to. That is probably going to be even worse than this Supreme Court. Those are the political realities that we're facing. So beginning with Elaine Jones, about the strategies that the people given the conservative political climate in this country and given the institutional control by the Republican Party of all of our branches of government, how do we get around that, beginning with Elaine Jones?
Not only by the people on this panel, but by our elected members of Congress that we have to give another message to.
But we are still in the minority, as you know. So. But we are still in minority, and we still need a lot of help.
So. We've been a minority all our lives. Listen. And, you know, I know your state well. I know y'all say I spent the first 5 years as a practicing lawyer litigating death penalty cases all across the state of Alabama with Judge Clement and others. I mean, all across the state. So I hear what you're saying. But you see, remember, we go back and are we worthy of the legacies we've inherited? Fannie Lou Hamer, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired. You see, so first thing. We have political power
that's right, baby.
That we don't use.
Yes.
We've got capital. Jesse called them rocks lying around. Votes that we don't cast. And we have political discussions about why should I vote? They going to do what they do anyhow. I mean, no, you know. You've been in those discussions. We have, that Voting Rights Act is still law. We just settling with the Justice Department redistricting case in Louisiana. We have, if we got out and exercised the franchise, not only exercised it, when folk are elected, hold them accountable.
Yes.
And hold them accountable. Hold them accountable. You know, you as a district office, you don't have to have the money to travel, but you ought to know what the agenda is. You ought to be in that meeting and vote. And look, those of us who have the privilege and the blessing to be able to get a college, a university education, we owe it.
Yes.
We owe it to interact, to dialogue, and to learn and understand and be spokespeople. And now, look, also as lawyers,
that's right.
Now let me tell you, there's a role as lawyers. Thurgood Marshall knew his role. Thurgood Marshall was not a community organizer, but he knew the community had to be organized. You know, and Thurgood Marshall and Martin Luther King understood each other. Then the Sunday does it. Martin said, look, I'm going out here. Thurgood said, Martin, I'm not sure you should go out there and get those kids and everybody in trouble. And Martin said, well, I got to do what I have to do, Thurgood, and you do what you do. You come get me out of jail. So that's what I'm talking about. Some are organizers, you know, some people have different strengths, but we need to tap into our strengths, and with our collective strengths, then we form our strategy. Now listen, all the lawyers, I want to say one thing. The sister here made a brilliant point about the looking at the Constitution, where the law is going, looking to the future. One thing we got to remember, you know, the law is not static. If you win it one day, it doesn't mean you got it. No, you can't rest on your laurels. They'll take it away. We won Brown 50 years ago next year. And look where we are now. So it's ever, you have to be ever vigilant. Now, one of the key issues as lawyers that we have to find a legal strategy to deal with ASAP, the 14th Amendment. The court has taken away the 14th Amendment. And they took it away in Bakken. The Civil War Amendment, which made us citizens, gave us equal protection of the laws and due process of law. The amendment that brought black folk into the Constitution and all of our other folk who are non-white. Now listen, the court said in Bakken, and that's where the doctrine first reared its ugly head, that there's certain discrimination that is so pervasive. Racial discrimination is nothing we can do anything about. They call it societal discrimination. In other words, it's discrimination in the air. It's in the water we drink, in the air we breathe. And everybody knows it's out there, but it's so pervasive that the law can't remedy it. What if the court had said that about gender discrimination? Think about it now. If a gender had said, discrimination against women is so pervasive and so widespread that there's nothing we can do about it. That doctrine has not found its way into the law, but it's in there on race and ethnicity. They have taken the 14th Amendment. That was the scourge of Bakken. And so what Justice Power did is snatch victory from the jaws of defeat and say, all right, but diversity is an important rationale. And the right went to the educational institutions. It wasn't a personal right of the individuals, which what remediation gives us. So that's our job. As lawyers, those of us who are going to use this profession as a craft, our job right now is to find a way to make sure that the law recognizes that the 39th Congress that passed and adopted the 14th Amendment was an affirmative action Congress.
Let me go to Mashonda Baldwin, and let me ask the same question I posed to Elaine Jones. Given the fact that the other side, if you will, has been winning a lot of the elections in this country, whether we like it or not, what's the strategy for your generation to deal with that?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I've taken copious notes. So let me just say this. And I'm going to piggyback on a question you asked a little earlier about the next battlefield or the next battleground. Now, I happen to be a Desert Storm veteran, so I was trained how to fight a war, how to fight a battle. And so strategy is what it's really all about. And for our community right now, one of the key things we need to do first, and to piggyback on Dr. Tatum, is we need to deal with the psychological effects of our community. Right now, the argument that we really need to be talking about is how are we right now victims of conscious slavery? Even though we're not in physical bondage, we're still feeling the effects. So one of the key things, one of the strategies as we begin to plan for the future is about healing. And that's healing our community. And how do we do that? That's the first thing. The second thing is we need to rededicate and re-educate ourselves. Right now, we've heard some wonderful examples of how some of the biggest issues today, we're talking about education, healthcare. We need to re-educate ourselves on the priorities that have a direct effect on our community. The next thing we need to do is we need to change our leadership style. Right now, We have individual leadership. We need to go back to the basics and go to servant leadership. See, because America will have us believe that we need to be individuals. But that's not the spirit that we come from. The spirit of Harriet to go back into to the South to free people, that's the spirit of a sense of community that although I'm free, if you're not free, then none of us are free. So as we move to this servant leadership, what we need to really understand is we have to stop being excited about being first or being the second black this or that. And we need to understand that leadership is really about, when you're a servant leader, it's about getting in the trenches. And when you get in the trenches shoulder to shoulder with those who truly need the help, your collective unconsciousness of the entire group will rise. So right now, we need to move from that individual to the servant leadership. And the last thing I'm going to do is one of the key things that we need to do as a community, we need to start pointing out the inconsistencies of our leaders. And I'm going to give this example, and then I'm going to be quiet. The example is this. Let's look at this, for example. President Bush gets up, and he talks about this case and the University of Michigan and affirmative action and quotas, and he throws all these things out there. However, President Bush is the commander in chief of the armed forces. The military has one of the most aggressive affirmative action policies in the country. Now, what does that say? Does that say that black people can go and die, but we can't educate ourselves? And then I'm going to end with one last point. Going back to the spirit of Harriet Tubman, and we look at the future and people say, you know, what are the young people really thinking about? Well, the image I have of Harriet walking around with the shotgun. And she didn't have a shotgun because she was going to shoot. It was about making sure that the people who was going ahead was going to stay. Because sometimes we don't know what we do. However, today, the image that we need to walk with is the gavel and the sword. And it's the gavel and the sword because we need to cut a path to the truth so that we could bring the justice.
Let me go to George Curry, and just one note for the audience. In about 10 minutes, we're going to give you all a chance to ask questions. To the panelists, we can do one of two things. In 10 minutes, we may have enough time for three or four people to talk. That will require probably two-minute answers from everybody. So I'll leave it up to you all if you're going to do that or not. Let me pose this question to George Curry. Same question I posed to Ms. Jones and Ms. Baldwin. Given the conservative hostile world around us, what do we do to overcome that?
Well, first of all, the University of Georgia say we have $645 billion a year in spending power. If you count all people of color, you're talking about $1 trillion a year. Now, the first thing we do is we call these corporations to account. For example, there were a lot of corporations who said, I'm for the University of Michigan Diversity Program. Among them, Chevron, Texaco, Pfizer, Xerox Corporation, Altria Group. These are also the same groups that gave money to the very organization that's opposing the University of Michigan. We're talking about a group that one book says, the Assault on Diversity says, the Center for Individual Rights is perhaps the most politically extreme of the groups challenging affirmative action, civil rights, and racial equality in the United States today. Now, you can't come to our community and give your little parties and your little reception at CBC weekend and all our black organizations parading and say, I'm a friend of diversity, and then give money to the very worst of the worst right-wing groups. So I say that people who oppose our interests, we should oppose and withhold our money. Not just those who supported them, but also the one who didn't file in support of the University of Michigan. And second, I want to follow up the earlier point, is I think some of our leaders must be taking some hush money. Because I can't hear them out here on this issue. And if they can't stand on this issue, we don't need a change of leadership styles. We need a change of leaders.
Julianne Melba.
I'm so glad you said that. You know, our president is such a hypocrite. I mean, he looks at Iraq and he keeps talking about regime change. I want regime change too, but I got to wait. You know. You know, I have to wait till 2004 to get mine, but our esteemed congressman said that he's likely to be reelected. That's up to us. Yes. But let's look at the damage that is being done right now, because we can talk about affirmative action, which is critically important. But let's also talk about the fact that affirmative action is looking at many of the elite institutions, where most of our young people, if they get to college, as Rosa has said, because many are not even getting there, but if they get to college, many of them are going to our public universities, the state universities. We have... Every one of the 50 states is in financial trouble. Every single one of the 50 states is in financial trouble, which means in Ohio, a 19% increase at the Ohio State University of tuition. In Massachusetts, a 16% increase. In New York State, a 35% increase in the SUNYs. Every single state is having financial trouble. 1.7 million people, mostly older, mostly black and brown, will be dropped from Medicaid if states have to make the kind of cuts that are supposed to be made. And those who are not dropped will find their benefits set shrinking. People keep talking about K through 12. I think that Mr. Foreman and others have talked about K through 12. Well, again, this No Child Left Behind should have been No Bush Left Ahead. But I mean, you know, just really. Yeah, but there's no millionaire left behind in so many ways. But we will be cutting K through 12 education. You know, shrinking the pool of people who are ready to go to college. Meanwhile, a $746 billion tax cut, half of which goes directly to the wealthy. The Congress last week held the voting open till the middle of the night. Was it 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning last Thursday? Yeah. That they held the voting open because the House of Representatives almost put their foot down on this president. The Senate did. So when we look at affirmative action, we have to look at it in the context of what has happened. So much else is being eroded in terms of the social safety net, in terms of our basic rights. Public assistance. Half of all women on public assistance now must work 40 hours a week in order for states to get their qualification. Mr. Bush would like to raise that to 70% of the women. Crowding out what? Their opportunities for education. I will not go on because I know that we're limited on time, but I would just really appeal to folks to look at the devilment. This is utter devilment, and that is not a public policy term, but it's what's happening. The utter devilment that is being done to essentially reward the wealthy. One last thing, speaking of affirmative action. Not USAID just asked RFP to rebuild Iraq. Now, they ain't tore it up yet, but right. They put out the RFP already to rebuild it. Five companies have a right to bid. Halliburton, Bechtel, Floor, and two others. Herman Russell
Martin.
Of Atlanta, largest black-owned construction company, he doesn't get to bid. There's no minority-owned business who get to bid. I'm not suggesting that the brothers go to Iraq to rebuild. But I'm just saying, this is the mindset. The wealthy get more wealthy. And how dare Dick Cheney use his inside track to empower his company? But more than that, how dare we... How dare our elected members of Congress, how dare our so-called civil rights leaders sit silent yes. while this happens?
I just need 20 seconds. I'm taking 30 seconds, and I'm watching the clock right now. First of all, Bush was selected. Okay, he was selected by the same Supreme Court that this case is going to go above. That's one thing. Second of all, I think that in terms of political power does not only come from the vote. It comes from people having the ability to vote, but also, you know, like the Black Panthers were talking about, political power sometimes got to come out of the barrel of a gun. You know, and we're living in them type of times right now, y'all. I'm seeing it. I live it. A lot of us, if we didn't have the privilege to be on a campus, would be straight living on the projects right now, having to hustle just to eat. So let's be very real about that. So as we look towards the 2004 election, because the sister was talking about fighting a war, Che Guevara talked about guerrilla warfare. And the first tenet of guerrilla warfare is to use the devil's resources against them, right? Whatever that devil might look like right now, he looks like Bush, Giuliani, the rest of them. right? So whatever that person looks like, how do we use those resources for real? How do we reclaim our space as Africans, as indigenous people? And how do we get away from a two-party system? Look, I come from New York. I know what Charles Rangel has done with an empowerment zone in Harlem. You know what Charles Rangel has done with an empowerment zone in Harlem? I'm telling you what he's done. You go to Harlem, and you can have your Starbucks coffee for $5, get your Body Shop cream, go to H&M, and then go buy a record at VIM. That's what empowerment zones have gentrified our communities. So I want to see 5 parties, 6 parties, the People's Party. I'm tired of this whole Democrat-Republican thing. I'm tired of that, because a two-party system, that's not democracy. Democracy is when someone like me, like the brother here, like anyone in this audience, doesn't have to spend $1 million to get elected. Then once they're elected, have to fight the next 20 months. And I come from this perspective because I worked for the New York State Assembly for 3 years with the Black and Puerto Rican caucus. I've seen how those officials can only do something for 2 months, 3 months, and then 21 months have to raise money just to get back in office. That's not political power. We the people are political power.